We are ready for part two. Here we go. And the bad news is, from here on in, it gets a little bit messier and a little bit less precise. For conjugate gradient, symmetric, positive, definite, we knew all there was to know, everything was beautiful and lovely pictures. So unfortunately, life is not like that. So first of all, we'll ease you into it gently by saying, right, you're allowed to still be symmetric, but what happens if we're looking at indefinite systems? So I have a matrix A as before. It's symmetric, but now it's indefinite, so it has both positive and negative eigenvalues. And V transpose AV might be zero for some non-zero vector V. So why can we not just apply CG to this matrix? Well, first of all, the matrix A can't be used to define a norm, right? We've been looking at the error in the A norm. If we have this property here, then A can't be used to define a norm. And also, we saw in the CG algorithm when we were calculating our step distance alpha that in the denominator, we had something like PK transpose APK. So clearly, if there's a possibility that's going to be zero, then we're going to be in trouble. Okay, so this is the bad news. So what can we do to deal with this? Well, maybe the first thing you would think of, indeed this was done by Stiefel in 1955, was to use what's called the conjugate residual method to say, right, well, A is not symmetric positive definite, but A squared is. So instead of solving AX equals B, I'm going to solve A squared X equals AB by the conjugate gradient method. Okay. So the conjugate residual method essentially looks like the conjugate gradient method, constructs iterates in the same space, but instead of minimizing the A norm of the error, it's minimizing the A squared norm of the error, which is the 2 norm of the residual. Okay, so this now defines a norm because it's symmetric and positive definite, so there's no problem there, but we're minimizing something different, minimizing the 2 norm of the residual. The good news is that all the search vectors and so on can still be calculated in a cheap way using short-term recurrences. So again, here's a representative algorithm for conjugate residuals. It doesn't look that different from conjugate gradients, but we've got what amounts to A, PK transpose A squared PK on the bottom here. Okay. Now, the way this is written, this is not illustrated, but in fact, you can implement this again only using one matrix vector multiplier per iteration. Okay, it looks like here I need to find APK and ARK plus 1 and so on. This is not the case. You can just implement this with one matrix vector multiply. So, that's all well and good. What's the problem with doing this? Well, the problem is going to be the convergence. We can go through exactly the same sort of eigenvalue polynomial-based convergence analysis that we did for the symmetric positive definite case. And for conjugate residuals, we come out with a very similar result at the top there, where we're still looking at some minimax polynomial, minimizing the maximum value at the eigenvalues. But the trouble is, if we look at the Chebyshev bound, then instead of having the square root of the condition number in the number of expected iterations, we're going to have the condition number. Okay, because we've squared the matrix essentially. So somehow we're squaring the amount of, well, we're squaring the condition number in the estimate for the number of iterations. Okay. Just to illustrate how the polynomial theory works, here's an example. Here's a minimax polynomial for an indefinite problem. It's the same thing, it's just a more complicated approximation problem because you have positive and negative eigenvalues, and you remember you must pass through the point 0, 1. So the actual theory, I haven't gone through any of the details here, so it's really exactly the same as we did for CG in terms of the minimax polynomial. In terms of the Chebyshev bound, which may be realistic if you have very evenly spread eigenvalues, then you're squaring the condition number, which is not really such good news. So the question is, can we do better than just this very elementary approach that says, let's square the matrix? Well, let's think about what we could do. What were the potential problems with conjugate residuals? Well, we saw that we may have breakdown if the denominator was close to zero in alpha k. And in fact, the conjugate gradient residual, the conjugate residual method, as I've described, is actually unstable numerically in this form. So, how can we get around that? Well, we can try and retain the idea, but implement it slightly differently. Okay, so the idea was, instead of minimizing the A norm of the error, we were minimizing the A squared norm of the error, or the 2 norm of the residual. Okay, so we're going to stick with the idea of minimizing the 2 norm of the residual, but we're going to try and generate the orthonormal basis for the subspace in a more stable way, keeping this cheap 2 or 3 term recurrence relation. Right? We don't want to incur extra costs in doing this if at all possible. So this kind of philosophy led to a mathematically equivalent but stable method, which is MinRes. Okay. I should maybe reiterate, especially for this, the second and third parts of the talk, that a lot of this is biased in the sense of my experience, right? So the methods I'm highlighting, choosing from the different methods available for symmetric, indefinite and non-symmetric problems, are generally those that I have worked with myself and know a little bit more about. Okay, so I'm going to focus on MinRes for that reason. So here is the structure of MinRes. We're still constructing iterates in the Krylov subspace, but we're going to construct xk which minimizes the 2 norm of the residual instead of the A norm of the error. Okay. The residuals in this case are orthogonal to the shifted Krylov subspace, shifted by the matrix A. And we're going to construct these by saying xk is x0 plus some matrix vk times a vector yk, where this matrix vk has columns which are orthonormal eigenvectors. The columns form an orthonormal basis for the Krylov subspace. Okay, so let me just say that once again. If we can generate orthonormal basis vectors, then we construct an iterate, which is going to be a linear combination of those vectors, xk. So the key question is, can I construct this basis cheaply? Right? Do I have a 2 or 3 term recurrence relationship to give me these vks? If these are really expensive to construct, this method is a non-starter. And the good news is that we can do precisely that by using the Langschoss method to find these vectors vk. So we use Langschoss to find vk and then construct iterates of this type, bearing in mind that we're minimizing the 2 norm of the residual. That's where the name comes from, right? MinRes. Yeah.
What's yk?
Yk is something we're going to have to find, right? So we're going to know, we're going to construct the orthonormal basis, then our iterates will be constructed by choosing yk so that the residual is minimized. Okay? That's what we're going to find. So here's a quick refresher course on the Langschoss method. And we have a 3-term recurrence relation for generating these basis vectors v. Okay, I've just written out the coefficients here. In particular, note that the first vector is just a scaled version of the initial residual, okay, because we'll use that fact in a moment. So the Langschoss method was, I guess, primarily suggested, although I'm not entirely sure if that was the right historical perspective, but it's primarily used, I guess, for finding estimates of extreme eigenvalues. Okay, so in the Langschoss method, you take these coefficients here, the alphas and the betas, you construct a tridiagonal matrix, and the extreme eigenvalues of this tridiagonal matrix tend, as the iteration progresses, to the extreme eigenvalues of A. Right, so that's really what the method was proposed to do. What we're interested in is this relationship here, which comes out of the Langschoss method. So I'm going to construct a new matrix, TK hat, which is the tridiagonal matrix from Langschoss with an extra row added, containing an extra coefficient. And then we get this green relationship here. A times vk is vk plus 1, i.e. the same bases with an extra column, times TK hat, this extended tridiagonal matrix. So why is that useful? Well, if we now go back to the MinRes idea, what we do is we use the Langshaw's method to produce our tridiagonal matrix. Then here's the key thing. We're going to construct our iterates to minimize the residual, the true norm of the residual at each step. So here's the residual, and here's the form of my iterate. Now you can see in green the relationship that we had at the bottom of the last slide. So I can replace my A times VK up here by VK plus 1 times TK hat. What good does that do me? Well, I can now take VK plus 1 out the front here as a common factor, precisely because R0 was a scaled version of the first basis vector, okay, as I pointed out on the last slide. So we can write the residual in this form. So what are we trying to do? Well, we're trying to minimize the true norm of the residual. So because the VK are orthonormal basis vectors, if I take the two norm of this, I'll get a VK plus 1 transpose VK plus 1 in the middle, which is the identity. Okay, so minimizing the residual is equivalent to minimizing this part here, where TK hat is now tridiagonal matrix. Okay, so what we're going to do in MinRes is we're going to solve this problem here, basically at each step. And this is a least square problem for these unknowns YK. Because once we've found the YKs, we put them back into our iterates with the basis functions. Okay, so we've got a least squared problem for YK, which we can solve using Givens rotations and a QR factorization of TK hat. Right, let me just see where I'm at. So I've put into the slides a copy of a sample algorithm from MinRes. This is taken from Bernd Fischer's book, this particular one, to give you an idea of this sort of setup. So there's an initialization stage where you set up all your initial vectors and so on. Then there's a kind of Langshaw's part, which you can see here's the Langshaw's recurrence that I'd written out on the previous slide, where you calculate your vectors V. Then there's a part that does QR factorization, Givens rotations, and then you can update your vectors at the end. Okay, so we've got this very clear structure whereby we use the Langshaw's vectors to produce a least squares problem, and then we solve it by QR and Givens rotations. And you see from the form of this algorithm again, it's going to be pretty cheap in terms of calculation. We've only got the one matrix vector multiply AVK plus 1 here per iteration. Okay, so it's in a nice cheap form due to the Langshaw's three-term recurrence. Okay. Now these are certainly not the only methods that are available for symmetric indefinite problems. As I said, I've chosen to focus on MinRes. There's also, for example, SimLQ, which Page and Saunders method, and it's very briefly summarised here. It has a very strong Langshaw's connection also, but instead of minimising the true norm of the residual, which is what we were doing, then it minimises the true norm of the error. Okay, but it follows the same sort of ideas in terms of the Langshaw's connection. And there are also methods such as orthodir and orthomin and orthodir, which are mathematically equivalent to MinRes, but closer in implementation to a conjugate gradient type method. Okay, I mean the MinRes algorithm with its QR factorizations, given rotations, didn't look quite like the CG we saw in the first part of the talk. Okay, so these things look much more like conjugate gradient, conjugate residual algorithms when you see them. The convergence analysis of these methods, again, is pretty well understood, particularly with MinRes. There's work by Bernd Fischer and Andy Watson and David Sylvester that says if you've got eigenvalues either side of the origin, you can get estimates depending on the extreme eigenvalues of each part, how fast this thing will work. Okay, but I'm not going to go into any of that here. We have a fantastic talk coming up this afternoon, is it, Hen? All about symmetric indefinite methods, which I don't know, some of this may or may not come up in that, but that's the place to go for the expert overview later on today. Okay. Right, so now, having wormed you up with a selection of acronyms and different methods for doing the same thing in different forms, we take the plunge into non-symmetric methods. So take a deep breath, because things are about to get nasty. And the reason they get nasty is primarily this very first point here. It's a paper by Faber and Manteuffel, or a couple of papers, that's show that essentially, apart from a very few special cases, there is no Krylov type method which retains both a minimization property and a fixed length recurrence. Right? So these have been two properties, both of which have been very important. The minimization lets us look at the error and do convergence analysis and predict how good the method is going to be. And the fact that it's got short-term recurrence makes it cheap. Right? Every time we want to produce the basis vectors in Langevin, we only need to store the previous two vectors. Okay, and then we can throw away all the other ones, and then we shift up, we throw away that one, and so on. There's no need to store all the vectors and reorthogonalize against them all. That's not true in the non-symmetric case. So basically, we have methods which fall into three categories. The first thing we can do is not worry too much about this and take, again, what I'll call the sledgehammer approach and say, well, okay, A is going to be non-symmetric, A transposed A is going to be symmetric. Okay. So if we do this, we can then go back to using conjugate gradients. So this is what's usually called conjugate gradients for normal equations. We'll get onto that in a moment. And it's certainly a perfectly valid approach. Alternatively, we could say, right, well, I'm going to forget about the fact that I can't have a fixed term recurrence, and I'm going to retain the minimization property. So I'm going to look for a method which keeps minimizing in the way that we've seen, and I'm not going to worry too much about the fact that I don't have this fixed length recurrence. Or alternatively, I could say, well, the fact that I've got fixed term recurrences is really important to get a cheap method, so I'm going to hang on to that fact, and I'm going to sacrifice my minimization property. See, I'd rather have a cheap method than one with a minimization property. So these are kind of the three different areas that you could divide up non-symmetric methods into. So we're going to essentially look at these in turn. So first of all, look at CGNR, conjugate gradients applied to the normal equations. So, as I just stated, we change our system to have coefficient matrix A transpose A, and we use CG. So our iterates lie again in a Krylov subspace, and this is our right-hand side A transpose, if you like, and here's our coefficient matrix. So this is exactly as with normal CG for this new system. XK is now going to minimize the error in the A transpose A norm. And again, that's equivalent to minimizing the residual. Okay. And the residuals we produce are going to be orthogonal to our Krylov subspace. Okay. So this is, we've seen all the theory, we know it works, it's guaranteed to be okay if we apply CG to the normal equations. What about its convergence? Well, what we end up with is the same old story. Of course, we know it's a polynomial. This time it's going to be a polynomial in the squares of the singular values of A. Okay, I see there's a 2 missing off my norm there. That's a 2 norm of the initial residual on that side. So again, essentially what we've done is we've squared the condition number, if you like. Right, so it's very similar to what we saw with conjugate residuals. So the number of iterations is going to look like the condition number rather than the square, because we've gone from A itself to A transpose A, which is going to be the square of the condition number of A. Okay, so you might immediately look at that and say, oh well, that's absolutely dreadful. But what you have to remember is that we've already seen that this bound here might be very pessimistic. right? We saw that sometimes if the eigenvalues are evenly spread, it reflects everything accurately, but if they're not, then it might be very pessimistic. So it's always worth bearing in mind, you shouldn't immediately say, oh, I could never apply to the normal equations. If you happen to have a nice system with certain nice symmetric properties and so on, then CGNR might work very well. Okay, so this is another danger of hanging on to this condition number bound like it tells you everything. Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. However, of course, this still does not look so satisfactory. We've just kind of said, let's reduce this to a problem we've already seen, right? We were telling jokes on this mathematical topic last night. Very mathematician thing to do, say, oh, I don't need to tell you about this, as I lectured you on this in the last hour, right? So it's a little bit unsatisfactory. So we want to try and get something a bit more sophisticated, if you like. So that brings us on to the second class of these types of methods. These are the ones where we decided we were going to retain the minimization property, but we were going to sacrifice the three-term recurrence property. So let's see what we have here. We're going to construct iterates in the same way as we did for min-res. And we're going to satisfy the properties that we minimize the two norm of the residual, exactly the same as min-res, and the residual is going to be orthogonal to the span of the shifted Krylov space. Again, the VK form an orthonormal basis for a Krylov space in this matrix capital VK. The problem is, so this is up to here, the slide is basically min-res again. The problem here is that we can't use the Langschroth method, because the Langschroth method is for symmetric matrices. So what do we use instead? Well, we have the Arnoldi method for finding VK. That's the non-symmetric equivalent, if you like. So here's a reminder of what the Arnoldi method does. It constructs a series of vectors Vj, these scaled Ws, where W is constructed in this relationship here. So what's the difference between this and Langschroth? Well, in Langschroth, remember, we had this short-term recurrence that meant we only needed to keep the previous two vectors. Here, we need to store all the Vs right from V1 up to Vj at a particular step. Okay, so this is the difference between GMRes and MinRes. With MinRes, we had the short-term recurrence to generate these VKs. For GMRes, using Arnoldi, we have to store all the vectors up to the particular iterate we're at. So instead of a tri-diagonal matrix, we have an upper Hessenberg matrix. So that means it's like an upper triangular matrix with that extra stripe below the diagonal. Okay, because we don't just have connections between the three vectors, we have connections with all the previous vectors. So every row is filled in from the diagonal along. And in the same way as Langschroth gave estimates of the eigenvalues, that's what Arnoldi was really used for. The extreme eigenvalues of this upper Hessenberg matrix go to the extreme eigenvalues of A. But again, from our point of view, we are primarily interested in this relationship here. We can take HK, we can stick on an extra row with the appropriate coefficient, and we get a similar relationship. A times VK is VK plus 1 times HK hat.
Something that Arnoldi know about Langschroth or built on Langschroth's work a year before or something?
I have no idea is the answer to that. Do you know the answer to that, Anne? No? No, I don't know. Yes, that's right, but makes you think that probably not, if that's the case, because they were so close. I guess people didn't communicate as much then. I mean, I don't even know where Arnoldi's from, actually.
It takes no, 2 years publishing.
That's right, yes. Yeah, I don't know. Anyway, we're going to use this Arnoldi idea in exactly the same way as we did with MinRes, so I haven't written it out again. We use Arnoldi to get the upper Hessenberg matrix. RK is now written like this, using exactly the same trick. So again, we've got a least squared problem for these YKs, which we can solve by Givens rotations and QR factorizations of HK hat. Okay, so it works in exactly the same way. The nice thing is that you might think this would be terribly expensive, but in fact, these Givens rotations give you a very cheap way of updating. You can get the QR factorization of HK plus 1 hat very easily from the QR factorization of HK hat. So this is a nice way of doing things. Okay. I've also mentioned here there are many, all the way through this talk, there's always alternative implementations available. I've just highlighted one here. For example, you can base the same sort of ideas on householder or organisations. It's actually extra work per iteration, but the algorithm may have better numerical properties. Okay, so all of these, there are very many variations on a theme. So, what can we say about the convergence behaviour of GMRES? Well, what we can say is that the residual norms can still be written as a polynomial times initial residual, where now we've got a polynomial in the eigenvalues, but they may not be real eigenvalues. Okay. The exact solution x hat is obtained in at most n steps. Well, that's the same idea as from conjugate gradients. If I can find a polynomial that fits through all of my eigenvalues here, then the residual is going to be zero. Right? It's exactly the same. So from that point of view, in a theoretical sense, we know that we can obtain the exact solution. We have this nice minimization property. That means we're going to get monotonically decreasing convergence curves. We're guaranteed to reduce the residual each step we take. Okay, that's the property we wanted to retain, and we have it here. Now, there are some convergence results for GMRES for special classes of matrices. So, for example, if your matrix is diagonalizable, in other words, if you can write it like this, where this is a matrix of the eigenvalues and eigenvectors, then we can produce a similar sort of result to CG. So if this green part here wasn't here, then this would just look like the conjugate gradient result. Okay, but the trouble is, of course, this green part is here, and this causes you a lot of difficulty. And the bottom line with GMRES is that the eigenvalues no longer tell you the full story. They may or they may not give you a good indication of GMRES convergence, but again, Anne Greenbaum and Zdenek Strakos have a paper which shows, and I'm just going to read this out to make sure I get it in the right way. It says, any non-increasing curve can be a plot of GMRES residual for some problem with any eigenvalues. Okay, so you give Anne a curve, and she can give you, I give you a curve and some eigenvalues, and you can give me the GMRES.
I'll give you a matrix.
That's right, yeah. That's right. You give me a matrix that produces that curve. Okay,
so.
Yeah, can you just explain this in the right way, Anne, for me? Sorry to drop that.
So you have some convergence curve. Maybe it converges fast, maybe it converges very slowly. And you say, can I get this slow convergence if all of my eigenvalues are really close to 1? The answer is yes. I can construct a matrix that will give you this very slow convergence even though all of the eigenvalues are really close to 1.
All right. Thank you. Perfect. So this is exactly the problem with GMRES, right? You cannot just extract the eigenvalues as we did in a nice way with conjugate gradients and see exactly what's going to happen. And there are various other results that people have shown. So I just quoted one of them here. If you can identify the symmetric and skew symmetric parts of A and you happen to have a positive definite symmetric part, then you can construct some sort of bound here. That's just really to give you a flavour of what people have tried to do. There are lots of bounds involving pseudo-eigenvalues and so on. People have really tried very hard to get different ways of getting a handle on how GMRES converges. But basically, I don't think there's a particular way that's accepted as being the best way of identifying how GMRES will converge. The nice thing, though, is that you can attempt to do some sort of convergence analysis because we have this minimization property, right? So if we didn't have the minimization, we couldn't predict anything. We've got this minimization. It tells us we're definitely reducing the residual at each step, so we can attempt to do some analysis.
came up with that bound in terms of the symmetric and skew symmetric parts? Is that the Ellman-Schultz thing? Or?
To be honest, I could not tell you off the top of my head exactly who it was. Yeah, I think it could have been Howard's, yeah. Is that right?
There are other algorithms too for weight positive.
Yeah, sure. And there are very many variations on all of this for, this, for the different things. Okay, so there are many ways of altering GM-RES, adapting GM-RES to try and improve it. The prime difficulty with it is the fact that we no longer have this short-term recurrence. So every step I take, I have to save another vector so that I can reorthogonalize with respect to, so my next vector is orthogonal to it. Okay, so the cross is increasing linearly. Every time I take a step, I have to save another vector. And in general, that's just not going to be acceptable for a real problem. So the first and probably easiest way of getting around this is simply to use restarted GM-RES. So to restart GM-RES every, say, m steps. So it's as simple as it sounds. You just take your first, you choose m to be, I don't know, 20 steps. You take 20 steps, you save 20 vectors. Then you reach that point, you throw everything away. You take your final vector as a starting vector for the next 20 steps. You orthogonize against these 20 vectors, then you throw everything away, and so on. So you keep restarting so that you don't have to keep accumulating your basis vectors. Okay. The trouble with this is that there's no simple rule for choosing M. Convergence speed can vary extremely drastically between values of M. Even, you know, if you choose 15 or 20, you might think, oh, it should be about similar. No, it can be completely different behavior. No one really knows how to choose the restart length. Although there's a little limited convergence analysis, people have tried to put some analysis with this to work out how one should restart and so on, but I would say it's not been so successful so far. Okay, but in practice, if people use GM-RES, then they almost always have to do it in this restarted form for a realistic problem.
Do they have to go through a trial and error?
Yep, that's usually what people do, I think. Yeah, certainly what I do if I'm running a code and I want to know, I'll do it with three different restart values, get a handle on which is the best. So the trouble is the minimization property is lost. You see, you have the minimization for your M steps, but then as soon as you throw that away and start again, you don't know what's going to happen to your residual. Okay. There are many variations on GM-RES. I've just picked out one here. Simpler GM-RES, Walker and Zhu. If you remember on the original GM-RES slide, we saw the residual was orthogonal to a shifted Krylov space to the original Krylov space. So basically what this method says is, well, rather than do what we did, which was calculate the orthonormal basis for the original Krylov space, why not calculate the orthonormal basis for this new Krylov space directly? Okay, so no details here, but you'll find it referred to in the many of the books and so on. And I have never used this. I am quoting from one of these many books when it is stated that this might be useful for restarting with small values of M, but has not really shown to be much better overall than ordinary vanilla flavored GM-RES. Right, so that's all I'm going to say on the second class of these methods, i.e. retain the minimization and throw away the short-term recurrence. Now we're going to move on to the other type, which were the bi-orthogonalization methods, which said we're going to forget about our minimization property, but hang on to the short-term recurrence. So here is a lot of information, most of which we don't really need. The key to these bi-orthogonalization methods is that they're based on non-symmetric Langschultz method. Remember, Langschultz has the short recurrences. Arnoldi, we had to throw the short recurrences away and do a full recurrence. So we're going to stick with Langschultz and use it in non-symmetric form. So the way that non-symmetric Langschultz works is that it generates two sets of bi-orthogonal vectors, V and W. So it's V transpose W which is going to give us the identity. Right? They're orthogonal to each other rather than within themselves. All the Vs are not orthogonal, all the Ws are not orthogonal, but they're orthogonal with each other. Okay? So I've just written down the algorithm and say it's really a case of too much information. Three-term recurrences for your Vs and your Ws. the V's span a relevant space, the W's span a relevant space. Here's our relationships that we need in terms of relating it back to Langshaw's. As I said, the vectors are orthogonal to each other, and they're related in this way to a tri-diagonal matrix GK. Okay, so these are the relationships that we're going to use to construct our bi-orthogonalization method. So it's really back to what we saw with Langshaw's and MinRes again in that sense. So this time I'm going to actually start with an idea of the algorithm before I tell you about the theories. This is the biconjugate gradient method, which again various people have worked on. And this looks very much like the conjugate gradient method we saw before, except we've got sort of parallel steps here. Here's our residual in terms of A, and here's our residual in terms of A transpose. So the bi-orthogonalization is giving us these two sets of vectors, two short-term recurrences, one related to A and one related to A transpose. So in terms of cost of this algorithm, this is what we need. We need one matrix vector multiply with A, and one matrix vector multiply with A transpose. So, what's the theory behind the algorithm? Well, we construct iterates much the same way. It looks the same as the other algorithms we've looked at. The residual is orthogonal to the span of R0 hat. Okay. So, you'll notice the difference here. First of all, there is no minimization property. Every other method I've had down, minimize two norm of residual, minimize A norm of the error, minimize A transpose A norm of the error, right? There isn't one in this method. Okay. Secondly, the residuals are orthogonal not to the real Kryloff space, if you like, but to this Kryloff space generated by R0 hat. However, the nice thing is that we still have our short-term recurrence. We've got two of them, but two short-term recurrences we can deal with. We're not having to backstore all of these vectors. Right, so what are the potential problems with this approach? Well, we don't have a minimization property. That means that we could have wild oscillations in the two norm of the residual. Okay, we'll see an example of this in a moment. And why is that a problem? Well, for the first, the most obvious thing is sometimes you have no idea where to stop, right? If you've got a convergence curve that's going like this, you stop at one moment, it's very low, next iteration, whoa, it's way up here again. It's very difficult to identify the appropriate place to stop. Okay. Now, there are also possible breakdowns in this algorithm. When, remember that there's these two sets of vectors now, pk hat and pk, so they may happen to create a zero on the denominator of one of our parameters, or our rk hats and our rk may be zero when they're not, the product of these may be zero when they are not both zero themselves, these vectors. So there are possible breakdowns in this method. So can we solve these and improve on by CG? Well, we can use what's called the look-ahead Langshaw's algorithm. So the Langshaw's is constructing these two sets of bi-orthogonal vectors for us. So I've just reiterated that here. So in Langshaw's, we're constructing V's and W's, and we may have possible breakdown if we get VK transpose WK equals zero. Okay. So at one step, we might not be able to find both Langshaw's vectors corresponding to A to the K V naught and A transpose to the K W naught. Okay, they've got these two things going in parallel. Sometimes there are problems. So what can we do to get around that? Well, what we do is we relax the bi-orthogonality condition for L steps just till we get past the difficulty, and then we can tighten things up again afterwards. Okay, so I mentioned earlier this is all a bit hand-wavingly, no details. Don't think there's any point in taking you through the nitty-gritty of this stuff, so I'm really just trying to give you the idea, but it's all detailed in the appropriate textbooks and papers listed at the end. Okay, so let me say in a hand-waving way, I'm going to still keep these properties that we use in our iterative method, that we have this tri-diagonal matrix here, but I'm going to throw away the property that our basis vectors are bi-orthogonal for L steps. Okay, it's called look-ahead line shows because you're kind of looking ahead to say, well, suppose I cheated for these few steps, would I be able to recover and get back on track? All right. The difference is that instead of a tri-diagonal matrix here, we now have upper Hessenberg block tri-diagonal. That's because, again, we're keeping some more non-zero entries in the row for these L steps. But the point is, this is going to be cheaper than keeping all the vectors all the way back to the beginning, just keeping them for L steps. So, it's possible to incorporate this look-ahead Langshaw's procedure into BICG to improve things in terms of breakdown. But that does nothing to help with these wild oscillations in the residual. We don't have a minimization property. So the next thought people had was, well, how can we try and use this BICG idea but improve this oscillations? So the next idea I'm going to talk about is the quasi-minimal residual method, or QMR method, of Freund and Nachtigall. Right, so now we're back to the familiar form. We're going to construct iterates just as we did in MinRes and GMRes, where the VK form a basis. We're going to use a non-symmetric Langshaw's method to construct this basis. So what's the problem with that? Well, VK is now not going to be unitary matrix. Okay, it's not going to create an orthonormal basis. Remember, the basis vectors it creates are orthogonal to the W's, the other series in the Langshaw's. They're not orthogonal to themselves, if you like. Okay, so what we did in MinRes and GMRes, we used this trick of writing the residual in this form, and then we said the two norm of the residual, this will disappear because V is an orthogonal matrix, right? So when we take the two norm, this drops out. So that's not the case here, because this is no longer an orthogonal matrix. So it's too expensive to just go ahead and minimize this because of this thing in here. So the idea of the QMR method is to say, right, well, let's just minimize this part of the residual. So we're not minimizing the whole residual, we're minimizing a similar part, looks like MinRes, but we're throwing away this information here, right? So it's not a true minimization of the residual, it's a quasi-minimization because we're trying to minimize part of the residual. Okay, so it's really BICG with this quasi-minimization property thrown in, and to avoid the Langshaw's breakdown, we have to incorporate look-ahead Langshaw's as I've just described. So here are a couple of details of QMR. As I mentioned, GK is now upper Hessenberg rather than tri-diagonal if we have to use look-ahead, but we can solve it in the same way, QR factorizations and given rotations. If A is symmetric, then QMR is the same as MinRes, right? Because we're minimizing, if it's symmetric, then we're minimizing the whole residual and we're just back to where we were with MinRes. QMR does suffer from incurable breakdown, but that's a kind of theoretical property which is unlikely to happen in practice due to round-off error. And there are some convergence results available for QMR, which is nice because again we've got some sort of minimization property. Here's without the green part, this is us back to the GMRes property which we had before, but we have to take account of the fact that we have not minimized with respect to this vector of matrix of basis vectors. Okay, so here's a relationship between the condition number of this matrix basis vectors, which relates the QMR residuals and the GMRes residuals. Okay. So, now we've got this idea of retaining the short-term recurrences. We can't have proper minimization, but we can try this quasi-minimization approach. One trouble with all of these algorithms I've shown you so far is that they've required a matrix multiply with A and a matrix multiply with A transpose. Okay. Now, sometimes that might be easy if you just have your matrix stored in some nice format. It's very easy to get the transpose. If you have something like sparse row format to save a very sparse matrix, then identifying the transpose and doing a matrix vector multiplier might actually be very difficult. So the next idea people had was, well, is there any method we can come up with that doesn't require A transpose? We'd rather multiply twice with A than multiply once with A and once with A transpose. Okay. So that leads us on to the idea of transpose-free methods. So let me just give you a few very sketchy details of some of those. First of all, there's a transpose-free version of QMR, which basically you can choose a suitable starting vector, which means you can eliminate the multiplication by A transpose and replace it by multiplication by A. So that's something to bear in mind if you're thinking of using QMR and you have difficulty obtaining the transpose. Another way of getting around this is the conjugate gradient squared method, CGS. And basically, the idea there is as follows. Suppose now I say the residual in the by CG case is some polynomial, pk by CG, times R0. Okay, we have this relationship. So the idea now is if this method is working well, then the residual will be small. So if pk by CG times R0 is small, then we would hope that pk by CG squared times R0 would be even smaller. Okay, so that's kind of the idea. If by CG is working well, then by squaring this polynomial, we can hopefully make it even better. And if this thing can be calculated cheaply, then this is going to be a good method. It's going to be better than just using by CG. So this is the idea behind conjugate gradient squares, kind of the squaring of this residual polynomial. So it turns out that this can be done cheaply. It just involves multiplying by A. You don't need the transpose at all, which is nice. However, the trouble with it is it's all well and good. If by CG works nicely, then CGS will very often work twice as fast because you're squaring your polynomials. However, if by CG is a mess, then this is even worse, because if this is rubbish, then you get rubbish squared with CGS. Okay? So it can really cause you trouble. And there are occasions when this thing may diverge when by CG itself does converge. So you can kind of see the evolution of all these methods, how people came up with problems each time and tried to deal with them. So the next approach was to say, right, well, how can we take this idea and refine it a little to get something less erratic? And this brings us to by CG STAB, which is by Henk van der Bos, 1990. And this was the, let me get this right, this was the most cited paper in the 1990s, I think, across a lot of scientific journals. I can't remember precisely what the sort of the place where they counted them, but I know because it was presented at a householder meeting in Sweden for the first time, this idea. And when we were writing our funding applications for the householder meeting in Peebles, we went and researched and said, here is a seminal paper presented at one of these meetings. So it's the most cited paper in science journals, and there's an article in Siam News about that, in fact, if anyone's interested. Anyway, let me tell you what the method is. Basically, remember CGS, we had here this polynomial squared times R0. Henk's idea was to say, well, instead of squaring this polynomial, why don't we multiply it by another but different polynomial? And we're going to construct this polynomial in a clever way. We're going to update it with a linear factor at each step. And I'm going to determine the factor, this mu k here, by solving a local steepest descents problem. So why is that nice? Well, it's adding an element of minimization. It's always what we're after in these methods. If we can minimize something, we're guaranteeing ourselves some sort of gain by doing a step. Okay? So because of that added minimization, convergence was typically much smoother than conjugate gradient squared. You might not be minimizing exactly the right thing, but you're minimizing something. Okay? And there are, of course, variations suggested upon this theme, particular by C.G. Stab 2. Martin Guttner suggested, instead of using an extra linear polynomial here, using a quadratic polynomial and calculating that with some minimization in the same sort of idea. And then this idea was extended to L steps rather than just two steps by Schlepin and Fockemann, the connections between restarted GM res and by CG in this method here. Okay. Right, so that has been a very surface look, if that's the right word, at a lot of these methods. It really is a bit of an alphabet soup, but hopefully it gives you a flavour of what each one might do. To finish off this part, I'll just give you one example of a PDE problem again, which I have actually worked on, calculating invariant tori. It doesn't matter, I'm not going to tell you anything about where this problem came from. This is really just to give you one illustration of how these methods might work. Right, so let's see what we can identify in here. First of all, by CG, it's easy to spot because that's the one I told you had erratic convergence, and hopefully no one will disagree in this particular problem. And this is why trying to decide when to stop this iteration, for example, you know, here this looks absolutely dreadful, and then it's down here, and you can see it really is a bit of a mess. Now, QMR, which was the version of BICG that tried to do the quasi-minimizing of the residual, okay, so it minimized the part of the residual without that VK plus 1, that's a red curve here. So you can see it's not unlike convergence of BICG, but it's an awful lot smoother. That's what that minimization property has done for you, smoothed out all these horrible oscillations. The other versions of BICG that we've just looked at, BICG STAB itself, interestingly, just would not work on this problem. It broke down altogether. BICG STAB 2 is the green line here, so this is the one with the quadratic polynomial by Martin Guttner, so it's still a little bit erratic, but it's much better in that sense than BICG until the bottom here. And funnily enough, the two version of Schlepin and Fockemann's BICG STAB 2 down here turns out to be the best in terms of iteration counts for this particular problem. Okay, so even these closely related methods have very different behavior. In terms of the minimization method, I just have GM res here. I don't have restarted GM res. So here's GM res in the pink curve, monotonically reducing residual as we'd expect. But of course, this is going to be expensive. By the time we've got up to 142 iterations here, we're storing our 142 basis vectors as we go along. Okay, so I've done this without caring about the cost. And finally, the conjugate gradient applied to normal equations as the very pale blue line here, and in this case it behaves very similarly to GM res. Okay, so that's just a flavour of the different methods for one particular problem. The trouble with non-symmetric methods is it's very much kind of try it and see which is the best one for your problem.
And one thing to point out about this is that, like, the BICG STAM methods require two matrix vector multiplies per iteration, whereas GM res requires only one.
So yes.
You might want to compare them for matrix vector multiplies as well.
Yeah, sure, that's a very good point. That's another thing to take into account. Some of these are, as Anne says, require two matrix vector multiplies. Some of them require A and A transpose. Again, it might depend what problem you're solving. This particular case, it was very easy for me to use either. So these all have to be taken into consideration when you're trying to choose your method. So that's why right at the beginning I said one of the drawbacks of iterative methods is it requires some expertise. You need to have some understanding of which method might be good for your problem, and if it's not, how you might want to improve it. Okay. I think I might suggest we have another little break here, maybe even just for 10 minutes, so, and then we'll come back and talk about preconditioning, if that's okay.